responsibility, right? So now, see, the deal with GarageBand is I have to start it. And then I have to pull up the PowerPoint because I can't see GarageBand because it's so big once it's on the screen formatted to go on there. So just kind of bear with me here. GarageBand is recording, I'm hoping. And we have our slideshow. And we're going to view the show and have GarageBand. Hopefully everything's working. Did you want to give me any? Yeah, you can do that too. And I am. There you go. Done. There we go. And I need to stay kind of near my computer, right? So that it will pick up my voice. And so it will stay plugged in, and so everything will happen. And this is a new room for me. You saw this, core competencies in your text. I don't want you to memorize these. But I want you to have some idea of the activity of nurses. Core competencies are based on using communication. That's where we really excel. We talk to patients, and we have the time to talk to them. So communication is definitely a core competency of nursing, as is knowledge. You have to have a foundational knowledge, which you're growing. Many of you have a lot of knowledge already that you're going to impart to your patients 2 weeks from Friday. You're going to be ready to start teaching. Technical skills, you're working on those. You were introduced to many technical skills, weren't you, over the summer. They will grow. You will become more and more proficient. You will learn new skills, more advanced skills. Technical skills are what we do. But I got to tell you, I've saved a lot more lives on my knowledge and observation than I ever have on my technical skills. Okay? So this is nursing in the 21st century. No longer are we just the skilled person that can put in a Foley. No. We're going to anticipate changes in heart rate. We're going to know that this patient's going down and needs some help, okay? You're going to see, because you're the one at bedside, and you're going to have that knowledge. So, yeah, you're going to save a lot more lives with your knowledge and insight and assessment skills than you ever will with your clinical skills. I mean, your technical skills, okay? So that's a real change in nursing. We're not just skilled. It's great to have good dexterity and all, because certainly, yes. But give me someone who can think. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so we have technical skills. Clinical reasoning. Yeah, this is what I think is the most important. Clinical reasoning and critical thinking. Can I help you? Oh dear, we'll go in the other class. Or do you want to stay here and then... Why don't you stay here for today? Yeah. Can you do what? Oh, I have rape, why don't you?
Sorry.
No, that's all right. And yeah, just, I thought, because I did have one more person. Remember, I had to give you my...
She called my name, and somebody told me she called my name.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I would start when quiz. Yeah, that's why. Because you were not supposed to be here. That's all right. Well, now relax. It's fine. I'm sure that Dr. Schutz will be understanding. And you'll get all the material, and I'll see you in the afternoon next week. Okay. All right, so that would be clinical reasoning. Good. The reasoning is, I'll switch classes. This is good for today. And critical thinking. I know you've had some lectures on critical thinking. That is a concept that's not new to you. That is a skill that we will absolutely work on developing, and it is critical for nurses. You need to be able to show me this semester, show your clinical instructor, that you can make sound clinical decisions. You can reason things out. No, you may not have all the knowledge today. Absolutely. Absolutely not. But what I expect from you is to be able, by the end of the semester, put the pieces together and come to the correct conclusion. And those are the skills I'm going to test. NCLEX type questions tested. And they will be getting increasingly complicated and a larger percentage of your exams as you move through this program. So at the very end, you'll be ready for NCLEX. But that's our goal. We're going to move you right on through. We're going to start the course with some knowledge-based questions, some NCLEX, and hopefully develop your thinking. It's got to happen this semester. it hasn't happened already. Gotta get that critical thinking piece in and clinical reasoning. Critical thinking is what's going to lead you into your ability to reason at bedside, clinical reasoning. And exposure to the hospital, you're going to get that. I don't know if you've done much reading about critical thinking. One way to teach critical thinking is modeling. So when you're with a nurse and they come to some decision, and you're kind of going, where did that ever come from? Ask the nurse, how did he go through that set of thinking? What did he do to get to that conclusion? And have them go through it for you. That will really help you. Have people model their thinking for you. That's very helpful. And you're going to be in an environment with lots of nurses, so you'll have the opportunity to do that. And they're good. All our facilities are great. Great nurses, great clinical instructors. You're going to have a good time. Okay, so clinical reasoning. Values. We all come with our own set of values, don't we? Do you think those you can leave those at the door of the hospital? We may try. Sometimes we can. Sometimes there are those that we should leave at the door. And there are others that we should absolutely bring in with us. There's nothing that's going to show you more about yourself than your patients. I've learned more from my patients than they've learned from me.
For sure.
Okay. Nursing not only encompasses your intellectual, but very much your emotional and your spiritual self. So expect that. You're going to be touched in many different ways as a nurse. Be open to that. Be open to looking at yourself critically. How do I feel about that? Why do I feel that way? Maybe I need to be more open. Maybe I can't be. In that case, I'm going to refuse that patient. I can't deal with that kind of situation today. And that's fine. Right? So your own values need to be explored. And nursing's going to bring it right in your face. And I've worked with seniors early in my practice. I said, if you're not crying at least one time after a shift, your first month as a nurse, a regular nurse, there's something wrong with you. If you're not in your car sobbing over a debt, over an unfair situation, over something that frustrates you, you're not pushing it. You're not thinking about it. Nursing is hard. It's hard physically. It's hard emotionally. And it's hard academically. But you're here. You're doing it. And I'm really proud of you. And I'll see you all at graduation, right? In just a couple of years. So know that, but expect it. Expect to be pushed. It's going to do it. And just be ready for it. And you have to look at yourself real hard sometimes. I've had to. Okay, so that's kind of the core competencies of nursing, right? What else have we got here? Functional patterns of health. Talked about self-perception. Coping, stress, patterns, value, beliefs, all this. On Friday, we're going to have a little blurb on effective coping. Okay. These PowerPoints are new to me, so bear with me. Okay, routine. You have a whole team. Interdisciplinary teams in the hospital. One of the pull-out sessions, if you're interested in this, is called Anatomy of a Hospital. Okay, Professor Walsh is giving, who are you going to run into? I sometimes step back on a med-surg floor and look. It looks like a bunch of ants running around. Everybody knows what they're doing. But you as a new nurse are going to walk in and go, we have other nurses, we have the techs, we have the secretaries, we have the physicians, we have the radiology people, we have the housekeepers, all sorts of people running around, and they're all in scrubs, and you don't know who is who, right? Okay, but we all work together. Bottom line is, for the care of the patient. No matter what level, that's what we're all doing, we're all working together. You need to communicate, you need to collaborate, you need to cooperate with all these teams, and it's very much a part of your practice. What's evidence-based practice? You've heard that buzzword before? Evidence-based? I know you probably did it if you were with me over the summer. Anybody else hear it? Did you hear it? What is it?
Yeah.
What is it?
Data, statistics, point of view.
Referring to?
Theory becoming practice. Say practice. All right, that's the first one.
Anything more concise? I think I got it, but anyway. Anything? Anybody have any? Yeah.
So the foundation of knowledge. knowledge based on science.
Yeah. Clinical. Not so much knowledge, but clinical practice. the practices we do, the paths we do, yes, local knowledge, is based in, yes, research. Absolutely. Was that always true in nursing?
No.
You think back when they were doing riddle checks, they were basing that practice on science? They were basing on tradition, right?
Yeah.
And what Mary Jo, the old nurse, said we were supposed to do, because we always do it that way in this hospital. You can't imagine how many times I did that. Why do you do it? Because we always do that way. Yeah. But, no. Luckily, now, I started practice over a decade ago, evidence-based practice is what we want. There are nurse researchers often employed in hospitals to seek out the evidence that will support the protocol for a certain procedure. Why do we change IV tubing lines every 72 hours? Why don't we change them with every new IV? Can we do that? What's the bacterial growth rate? For the pathogenic growth rate? So those are the kinds of things that are passed with science. And yes, you're right, peer-reviewed scientific studies. And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week when we talk about your little evidence-based practice project. So evidence-based practice is something you're going to research-based.
Clinical experience certainly comes into play with evidence.
Absolutely.
And research activities. Hopefully you'll have the opportunity to go to a conference. To do some reading. I'm going to force you to do some reading. Yes, peer-reviewed. And you will take a research course in your surgery here that will bring this to light a little better. If you're lucky and take it in the summer, you get me, which is really fun. I'm in the summer. Okay, errors. Another part of nursing, right? Errors. What are errors all about? Well, we do make mistakes, don't we? We need to identify and identified and safety principles are implemented through the application of quality improvement measures.
So when mistakes are made in a hospital, there are forms that are filled out and all. The reason we do that is so that we can improve. It's not to chastise someone who made the error. Often, in the book it says, right, most of the errors are not made because one person made a mistake. It's a system error. The training was faulty. Okay? The machine, the labels were confusing. Okay? Generally, although it's maybe the nurse that actually makes the error, it's more commonly it's a systems problem that needs to be looked at by the institution. So we're very aware of our errors because our errors can be so huge. Okay? Nurses have made errors that have cost people their lives. And never don't want to be any of us, right? But know that there's a whole system where errors are good, small errors are good. Make your mistakes with me, with your clinical instructors this semester, please. Please. Be frank about what you don't understand. Let's talk about it and get it out now so we can fix it. So that when you're in practice, you're not going to still have that. But I'm not really sure how it goes. Even if it's something very simple. Ask. Make your mistakes. Make them now. Before you walk in the kitchen, always before a nurse in any of my rotations, and I'm sure my staff does the same thing, we talk about it outside the room. Explain to me how you're going to do this. And they'll say, I'm not sure what to do next, and we'll talk about it. Do that. Make your errors now, okay? But you won't do it in practice. And know that when you do it, it's learning, it's growing. And most of the errors that are made in nursing,
as your text says, our problems with the system. Information technology, informatics. Yeah, that's great. Really coming into nursing. The computers are wonderful. You can look up every drug, every disease, you have everything right there. You'll have it on your Skyscape. You'll have everything. All the diseases, everything, every drug.
Also on the computers in the hospital, all the protocols. Information technology is amazing. In Kaiser, they have flow sheets for every disease. Everything. And if your patient experiences this, you go here. If they do this, you go there. If they do this, flow sheets. It's all mapped out. It's all technological. It's great. Knowledge is there for us. It's all there. Marine General, those of us who are Marine General, there are three sections of you at Marine General, so a large percentage. They are moving to computerized charting, like now. And I get to go on Thursday to a whole day and learn how to do it, and hopefully learn how to teach you. So we'll see how we do. That'll be a little bit of a challenge for us there. Slowly all the hospitals are moving over to computerized charting, so yeah, which is great. And then we get these lovely trends of heart rates and blood pressures and graphs, and it's awesome. And this will be very much a part of your practice. Attitudes, mental health skills. What about your attitudes? Necessary attitudes, mental health. Could independent thinking? Yeah. We want you to think independently. Your practices are your own beginning now. So there may be a time when we're in clinical and you'll say, what shall I do? I'll say, well, this is very much your call. How do you want to proceed? What do you think is best for this patient? It's your call. How much pain do you think they're in compared to how much they're telling you? How do you want to handle this? Independent thinking is necessary now, immediately. You're gaining the skills and we're there to support you. But independent thinking, your practices are your own. You need to be willing to listen. Listening is one of the most important nursing skills. You have to listen to your patients. You need to listen. What are they really telling you? I read an interesting report done on physicians and nurses, and they sat in on interviews with patients and recorded the amount of time that physicians spent listening compared to nurses. Physicians don't listen, like at all. They just give information. Nurses sit down and listen. We need to listen. One thing is we need to pass on what the patient really feels to the physicians because they're not listening. Okay? They're just imparting information because that's kind of their model. Listen to your patients, listen to your instructors, question. Alright? And in this rotation, the questioning is left up to you. I don't know what you don't know. I don't know when you're not comfortable. So you come to your clinical instructor and say, I don't know about this. Or, we had it in skills, but I don't remember a darn thing. And that's okay. Great. Question. Question the nurses on the floor. So questioning, empathy, you've got that or you wouldn't be here, right? But also be careful. Don't let it go so far that it won't impact your practice. If you need to walk away from the floor, do it. Absolutely do it. I remember a time when I was in an OB rotation. I thought I was fine. And my instructor said, you're not fine. Go away. Go home. And she was absolutely right. And I went, oh, she did. I got in my coffee. I was an emotional mess and I cried all afternoon. Because of the situation that the woman that I had been working with. Mm-hmm. And she was able to sense that in me before I even knew that I was that involved in. Okay, so, and that was a great lesson for me because it taught me, okay, I can't do that again in my practice. Because if you're with us, right? You can't help. So be careful. And these are the kind of personal values and gauges that you will be thinking about this semester. Take some time for some little introspection. It's very important. This is a skill, one of the skills you'll be developing. You have empathy, you wouldn't be here. Now learn how to regulate it and when it's appropriate in your practice. Okay? Fair-minded, yeah, we're obviously. Okay. Pretty fair, gotta be. Disciplined, yes. What about creative? Time for creativity in practice? You don't think so? Why would you be creative? I'll tell you about what I think was about. Yes, that's creative.
Well, if you visual
or
something like that,
like trying to be creative. Here comes the... whatever, the airplane. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of times for creativity, and you wouldn't necessarily think so. I'll tell you about what I think was my most creative time. This woman, her oxygen sats were fine. She was like 98, but she's elderly, she had a lot of lung problems, so I tell you this in labs. Okay, I told you this in labs, so bear with me if you heard it. And they're going, she's like, I can't breathe. I'm fine. No, I really can't breathe. She's like, getting up. So I took a nasal cannula and put it on here and put the end behind her bed. I then called the physician, called the family, told them what I did, called the respiratory therapist. So it was a, what do they call it?
It's like a
Yeah. It's like a somatic case. Right? And she was fine. So I thought that was pretty creative. Okay, so that's, there is absolutely room for creativity in this one. Right? I wouldn't recommend you do that without really covering all your bases. But I was in her room like every 10 minutes because she couldn't breathe. So yeah, it's okay. Be creative. Be self-confident. And I want you to know that when you walk in those rooms, what, 2 weeks from Friday? Yeah, 2 weeks from Friday, when you walk into your patient's room, be confident. You have a role in the hospital as a student nurse. We have contracts with each of those hospitals. The nurses know you're coming. They welcome you. You have a role. You have a place. And they also know that this is your first time on the floor. Okay? They do. They do. It's fine. They have that confidence. You might not want to tell your patients it's your very first injection, and in reality it's not, because you've had those poor hot dogs suffered all summer, right? Okay, well, I'm way off my thing here. Let's see, critical thinking. Okay, major concepts of critical thinking are divergent thinking. In divergent thinking, you weigh the importance of the information. Okay? So yes, you got information that the blood pressure is really weird, but you know very well that this CNA just wants to get off the floor, and so chances are that blood pressure wasn't even close to what it really is. So you look at the source, where the importance of the information. So, but this is important, so you better go back and look at yourself. Okay? Divergent thinking. Reasoning, the ability to discriminate between facts and guesses. Patient looks a little flushed. Maybe they have a fever. That's a guess, right? Maybe they have an elevated temp. So you take their temperature and you find out, and it's no longer a guess. So that's reasoning. Clarification, noting similarities and differences to shift out unnecessary information. And that's something that's very important for nurses. Because a patient will be talking to you and they'll have all this godly stuff. And in there is the pearl of information that you need. And when did you fall? Oh, let me tell you, I was so... Oh, the medication. And then it's a fall. All right. Did you hit your head? Oh, I was dead. So you sift through and you clarify. And this is what you get good at it. Reflection. Okay. Comparing different situations with similar situations. We all come to nursing with a different group of experiences, with a different set of situations, and we'll bring them into nursing. Compare them. What's applicable? What worked for me before in a similar situation? Great, maybe it'll work now. Maybe it won't. Yeah? And those are all types of critical thinking that you'll use. All right. This is, remember the nursing process, right? Remember that? Professor Bright assured me that you have a gap. Yes? Well, we're going to practice. Don't worry too much about it right now. We're going to do some practice at the conference. Okay? And you'll know exactly what we expect of you in the way of the nursing process. But remember, it's assessment, diagnosis, planning, inflammation, and evaluation. If you happen to forget. Which you didn't, because I know. The importance of nursing standards and goals. There are definitely guides to nursing practice. Okay. They protect the public. Nurses encounter legal and ethical problems almost daily. Yeah, almost daily they're presented with legal and ethical problems. Practice guidelines are a structure that we can use to guide us. You've reviewed the ANA codes. Have you had an opportunity to do that in front of the notes? Did you look at codes? Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. The American ANA, Nursing Association? Yeah. And there are others out there. I think we have other examples in your text too. And they protect the public, obviously. Right? Absolutely. Ethics is a frame of reference for nursing behaviors. Your book has a nice section on this. What's appropriate, what's not? When do you draw the line? Do you give a patient a phone number? I don't know, it's kind of gray.
What about
medical
take the call?
Well, it kind of, yeah.
Wait a minute on the appointment, right?
Right, I never have, but I'm not saying I never would. You know? Okay? Really depends on what's going on. So that's when there's a lot of gray. Ethics are a lot of gray. And there are values. Right. The general rule is no, absolutely not. Am I going to say never? No. This is all where your decision making comes in. What's appropriate?
Because maybe it's not health-related.
Maybe it's not health-related. Maybe there's some very cool gardening apparatus or some seed or, you know, some, who knows? Right, exactly. So I'm into my garden this summer. I have these special seeds.
You have an amazing nursery coming.
Yeah, we do, don't we? We do. It's where my artichoke plant came from. Yeah, my artichoke plant came from that. It's great. Okay, the ICN code. That's the intro. I have that in here. Another code of ethics. So it helps you set priorities, set judgments, take action, ethical dilemmas. And a little bit more about those in the text. And the ANA, we talked about that. General guidelines for nurses, principles of ethical concern. And we have these down in your book. You can take a look at those. I'm going to give you some handouts on Friday, too, that are just some real basic kind of guidelines for practice. And we measure the quality of someone's practice by how well they adhere to the codes. Absolutely. So within practice guidelines, you want to stay within practice guidelines. You also want to stay within the appropriate guidelines for a registered nurse. You can be found at fault legally should you step outside the scope of practice. Fall within my scope of practice. And I used to turn my silence out of my scope of practice all the time. And it may simply not be in my scope of practice because I wasn't trained enough to attend. Not that nurses can't do that, they sure can. But it's outside my personal scope of practice because I haven't had any training. But ask me to do a gynecological exam, which is something that RNs generally do. Yeah, I can do that. I've been trained in that. So your personal scope of practice, each of us is going to be different because of the skills that we have. But in general, you need to stay within your scope of practice, within your personal training, and within what is expected of an RN. And here's our standard of practice on and on in your text. We're caregivers, right? Yeah. We do a lot of that. A lot of caregiving. We give care. We act independently. I remember one student I had, he spent the entire day holding an old man's hand and listening to his stories. And he said to me, I feel so bad. That man really needed me today. I didn't get anything done. That's so much fun. He spent the entire day caregiving. That's what he did. No, he didn't work on any skills. No, he didn't work, he didn't chart it. He did caregiving all day. And that man will never forget it. He never forget that. So that, and as a student, please take the time to do that. You won't as nurses. You won't have the time to hold someone's hand for an hour. For 10 minutes. Maybe for like that. This young man did it all. Listen to his voice to me. Very therapeutic. But that's an independent act, right? He acted completely independently. Sometimes our caregiving is collaborative. We work with. I need to call the respiratory therapy to care for me now. I need to get a CNA in here. Caregiving is often collaborative. We're an art and a science. You know that. We're an art. Absolutely. The human body is still a mystery. Why we don't know. We create it. We work on intuition and never push that aside. Your intuition is very much a part of your practice, and you will develop more of it as you begin the practice and continue the practice. So yes, it's an art. You can feel good. We are an art based in science, okay? Which makes it very interesting. You provide comprehensive and individualized care. You're going to do your assessment, design your plan of care individual for that patient. You'll be doing that very soon. Plan of care that's individual and comprehensive. We're educators. And this is something you're going to do the first time you're there on the floor. You already know so much more than the average person about body, how it works, about disease, in general, about prevention. You have general concepts already you'll be able to impart to your patients. And if you don't know, you can go pick up all the pamphlets. Or at Marine General, we have these videos that we can show. You can sit and watch a video with your patient. Okay? Yeah, you can learn and you can talk to them about it. Education is something that I expect you to do every single day on the floor, and you can begin right away. If you're not sure of your skills, great, watch a video with your patient. That's fine, that works. Right? So we're very much educators. We're advocates. I'm sure that Professor Brock talked to you a lot about this, because I know it's a subject near and dear to her head. We advocate for our patients. I have stood in front of the bed and said, no, this patient doesn't want that. Yeah, we do, we advocate. Sometimes you have to be kind of strong. Our patients have the right, and sometimes it's only us sticking up for them. Or maybe it's only us who knows. Nurses, patients will confide a lot in you that you might want to present to the physician. You know, she's not real clear about this procedure. She's really not sure she wants it. She's not ready to sign a medical consent. We need to come back and explain this. It's the kind of thing we do, advocate for them. Or we may say to our patient, simply, you know, you don't have to have the treatment. I don't have to have it, but the doctor said. It's your choice, you know. Really? Maybe I should call my son and talk about it. Thank you. We advocate for their best interest. We manage time, people, resources, and the environment. Yeah. If you manage your own little environment in nursing, you'll be doing that right away. You're going to manage yourself. That's going to be plenty for you, right? Your first time on the floor. Thinking about your time management, your resources. Let's see, do I have to walk? If I'm walking down there, I can bring this with me. Then I won't have to walk down there twice. Your energy is a resource. You're going to start small. And you're going to get big. There may be a time when you're managing a whole hospital. But 2 weeks from Friday, you're going to manage yourself in your clinical environment. That'll be a good start. Okay? But know that that'll grow. You'll eventually manage a staff, maybe even a whole hospital. Okay? And we are researchers, yes. We are. There are nurse scientists with PhDs that do research. What's great about nursing is, if you're an LPN or if you're a nurse scientist, it doesn't matter. We're all working together for the good of the patient. Whether you're doing scientific studies on which protocols will be based, on which practice will be based, or if you're doing it, it doesn't matter. We all work together. So research is an important role in nursing. An important role for you as baccalaureate-prepared nurses. College of Nursing doesn't have a course in research. It's not expected of them. You'll be well versed in research by the time you graduate from this program. We're going to start a little bit this semester. Okay, you look like you need a break. Okay, why don't you take a break and I'll see you in like 5 minutes. That is sad, yes. I'm going to pull up another lecture, chapter 12. It's coming. And it would be helpful if I plugged in the projector, wouldn't it? Everybody's just about back. And those of you who are listening to me are wondering, what is she babbling on about? Yes. What's your question? The quiz, yeah? And that's right. I caught that, and people actually. That, so So the term plagiarizing is used incorrectly quite often. The term plagiarizing is used incorrectly in that situation quite often. In reality, you're cheating. You know? Okay, shall we get going? Are we ready? The question was about the quiz, and if you submit your own work, is it plagiarizing? And actually, the answer is cheating. Cheers. I will post the keys tomorrow morning, okay? If I don't, yell at me, drop me an email and say, you said I'll post the keys soon. This is not what I want. No. Sorry. I have the wrong PowerPoint now. Is that thing graded? Of course it's graded. And chapter 2, all about adult med surge. You show. Okay, what's health? You know this, right? Definition of health, very simple. A state of complete physical, mental, and social. Yes.
What time are what's
they're coming, they said sometime between 11:30 and 11:45.
11:30 and what?
11:45. Are you concerned about our schedule?
No.
I am. Since I'm blabbing on a little more.
Say hi.
No, you'll see it. You're not going to miss them. They're right here during our class time. Okay, health. Physical, mental, and social. All right? And social. So as nurses, that certainly brought into our practice, doesn't it? So if you're caring for a 15-year-old teenage girl, and she's isolated from her friends, and her mom says, wow, you know, she hasn't seen her friends. I really want to bring in some pizza and have her friends. You can facilitate that, because that is very, very important for her whole health, right? Her social being, okay? So yes, physical, mental, and social, and we address all those in our practices. Absolutely. Okay, someone isn't either healthy or non-healthy, right? It's not like this. It's not black and white. There's a huge continuum, big line, okay, between health and wellness, health and illness continuum. Sometimes you may not be quite as healthy as you are in other days, right? You may be kind of sad about something. Or you may have over-exercised. You get to be my age and do too much, it hurts the next morning. That's okay. You can just carry on. But am I optimum? No. All right? So remember, it's continuum. It's dynamic. It's constantly changing. One extreme is exceptionally good health. Well-rested. Good nutrition, good exercise, good body tone, right? All the areas of the body are functioning in an optimum way. The other extreme is death. So that's a pretty long continuum, isn't it? From one to the other. From health to death. And there you go. There's a wellness model, and then the treatment model goes right along with that, doesn't it? People have signs and symptoms, and they have a disability. This is a neutral point. Can't discern if you're ill or well, you're just okay. Wellness, people are aware. We can educate them. We can grow them into wellness, can't we? We can encourage them not to smoke. We can encourage them on an exercise program, and that's part of the treatment model, to encourage people into that high level of wellness. Kaiser has some great ads, right, about being healthy. Yeah, they really are. Their whole thing is promoting health. Okay, that's what we do. That's what nurses do. Explain the factors affecting functional health status. Right? It's important that we as nurses are involved with the patient in moving towards that wellness framework. If you don't have buy-in from the patient, they're not gonna do it. They're not gonna change. If you say, you should stop smoking and walk out, think you're going to have much of an impact? I don't think so. No. You need to talk to them about it. You need to kind of unfreeze them to make change. Okay? Like, you need to be involved in this class to get anything out of it. If you just come here and fall asleep, it's not going to do anything for anybody, right? And likewise, if I just make it real boring. You're not going to get much out of it. We have to interact, and that's what we're going to do, right? And same with involving your patients in their health. As I'm sure Professor Bright told you many times, nursing is holistic. Everything, correct? Yes. I'm sure that's not a new concept to you. Absolutely, genetics affect health. You may have that yourself. You may be predisposed to allergies. A couple of you were looking rather allergic this morning, I noted. Yeah, some of us have a predisposition genetically to allergies or to different diseases. We may carry genes that actually carry the disease, right? They're genetic diseases. How cognitive are we? What is our level of education? People may not know that drinking water from or chicken that's been sitting out is a health hazard, right? Okay, so that's important. What about your culture? What's acceptable in your culture? Here in Marin, did you read that the statistics that came out last spring that Marin is the most healthy county in the nation? Yeah, sure. That's culturally here. I grew up here, and boy, yeah, absolutely. You know, everybody runs, they're real athletic, we host food. I mean, everything's, I'm not at all surprised. That's a culture of this community. I was living in the Midwest when I got my education in nursing. No way is it the same there. I couldn't believe it. I was such a misfit. Well, it's completely different and not as healthy, right? Not at all. So certainly your culture, and that can be as simple as these were all people that look like me. There's no ethnic difference, but there's a huge cultural difference. Race, ethnicity, sure. Some races are prone to some problems. I'm Irish. We have colorectal issues. Probably because of all the white bread and potatoes we've eaten for generations with no roughage. Okay? So African-Americans, they have more cardiovascular issues. So yeah, some of it's going to be just cultural. Absolutely. Ethnicity, yes, maybe. How do you eat? Or is smoking acceptable in your ethnicity? Maybe, maybe not. And culture. Developmental level, sure. Are you able to care for yourself? What is your developmental level? Can a baby really be responsible? They eat dirt at 2, you know? Not very healthy. Okay? That could be a real problem. That's their developmental level. Okay? And again, an old person may have trouble cleaning themselves. May have trouble going to the bathroom. May be at a higher risk for infection. May have fall more easily. Right? So lifestyle and environment, yeah. Certainly. We have healthy lifestyles and poor lifestyles. And you're going to really see it in the hospitals. You're going to see how lifestyle truly affects these smoking, drinking people. They have more disease. They don't have the resistance. Their bodies aren't as strong. And you're going to see them. And do what you can to change your lifestyle, to move them into a more healthy environment. And yeah, where do you live? What's your environment? Or do you have clean water? Do you have enough money for good protein? For instance, I'm dating this Italian man who cooks. Culturally, he's very Italian. Cooks these wonderful dinners for me, like, every night. It's great. And so all summer, I've been going over to his house for dinner. I no longer need it. What do you know? I've been anemic for the last 5, 6, 10 years. I mean, since I was in nursing school. Because do I eat this well at home? So, I mean, there's an environment. The environment of his meals is so much healthier in that nice Italian culture. You know, the meat, my pastries, and tea that we do as Irish people, and, you know, the Irish are never known for food. Going over to his house meeting. So, yeah, it's amazing how the environment makes a real difference, right? Are you in a healthy environment where they eat a lot of red meat and fresh vegetables and pasta and, you know, don't buy everything. Everything is, like, fresh and from the farmer's market. So environment can make a difference. And I've only gained 3 pounds, which I think is darn good considering I've been eating like that all summer. Your socioeconomic background, yeah, absolutely. Do you have the money to buy food? When I was in nursing school, I didn't have the money, and I got in just the habit of eating, I think, rather cheaply that is carried on until the summer. Okay, so yeah. And you may be in that right now. You're eating a lot of mac and cheese. You know, you're eating, absolutely. My children lived on very little when I was in nursing school. It's okay, but now I need to move on. So social economic, sure, absolutely. Is there enough food? Is there enough? Are you a widow? We see this often. New widowers don't eat. It's terrible. They don't know how to cook. Their wives have always cooked for them. They don't know what they're doing. They end up in the hospital with failure to thrive. They're not doing well. There's no one caring for them. You'll see it. I'm sure you'll see it next semester. It's a common occurrence. They don't know how to do it, how to survive, how to make food. They don't know how to care for themselves. And geographic areas, sure. Absolutely. Where are you? We're in the United States. We're lucky. We have lots of food. In the Soviet Union, there was a time when they didn't have ionized salt. Okay? So that kind of thing makes a difference. What's the nurse's role in health promotion? Big. All right? I think if there's anything we do is to promote health. We teach patients activities that maintain wellness. Absolutely. Teach patients how to do it. It makes a huge difference. You never know if you're going to be the person that's going to say the thing that makes them stop smoking. And you can say it subtly, like, how much exercise do you get? Like my mother, who thinks that she was raised in a time when women didn't sweat. So she doesn't exercise. She's never exercised. Ladies don't sweat. But she does a great job of parking, like 2 blocks away from the grocery and walking to the grocery and walking back. Okay, so she works it into her daily life, but heaven forbid, she would never go to the gym. Okay, so you take your patient like that and you say, okay, what's going to work for you? Why don't you park at the outskirts of the parking lot? Your car's not going to get dinged and you can walk a little further. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Or you don't like to walk in the rain, but you like to go window shopping, walk around the mall. You know, so be creative. This is nursing creativity. Work it into what will work for your patient. You're not going to tell them to go run around the track because that's what you do, right? No. No. Well, Mom, we'll go do aerobics. Want to go to a Zumba class? No, right. That's not going to happen. Okay? So you work it into them. But you, too, serve as a role model. You can say, yeah, you know, like, I hate jogging. And I say, yeah, I hate jogging, too. I can't do it. So I dance. It's much more fun. So we're told that don't talk about yourselves. But sometimes you can use yourself as an example or a role model. Yeah, I had trouble with that. Or I remember when I quit smoking. Oh, it was awful. And if you did. Or some challenge that you had. That's fine. And a little bit. Characteristics of health. Health, as we said, is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. Don't forget the three elements. We're not just caring for the physical as nurses. Physicians, what's their job? What do physicians do? Exactly. Their focus is to eradicate disease. That's what they do. Their focus is disease. We focus on the patient. Okay? So don't fault the physician that comes in, concentrates on the disease, gives information on the disease, and doesn't deal with everything else. That's their model. We deal with everything else. That's our job. Okay? And see how important they are to work together. They will look to us. How's she doing today? Tell me, how's she really doing? Because you go into that little old lady, the big physician in his white coat walks in, and she's going to say, oh, I'm fine, doctor. And then he'll say to you, what's she really doing? All right? So we serve that role a lot. We look at everything. Well, she's really upset because her son hasn't come and visit her. And he'd say, I know something was wrong. Do you think if I called him, it would help? Yeah, would you call him? Okay, that kind of collaboration is very, very important. And that's what you do as a nurse. You're like the kitchen, you know, everything kind of in the house. Everything comes from you. And holistic, looking at all these aspects of your patient. Disease is an alteration of body structure, function of the mind or the body. We don't limit it to physical. Okay? Your patient may be very emotionally upset. That's going to impact their healing. That's going to impact the disease process. So again, all of it, mechanical, normative, biological. And there's some examples from your book. Acute. The symptoms are acute. And a chronic disease. Chronic is long-term, right? Okay. Acute is fairly short. I've actually heard a definition that acute can last up to 6 months. That's normally not how we look at it, though. Acute is usually rather short. Chronic is something that goes on for a long time. Diabetes is a chronic disease. Heart disease is generally a chronic disease. Acute may be a virus you get. Pneumonia can be acute. Okay. Communicable, something that can be passed from one to the other. Congenital, something that you're born with, different than genetic. Okay? Genetic, it exists in your genes. Congenital may be simply babies are born with hip dysplasia, for example. That's not genetic. That's how their body formed. Yes?
Down syndrome
is genetic. That's a perfect example of genetic. Because there is a change in the genes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas congenital hip, where the hip is born out of, they're born with the hip out of the socket, there's nothing genetic that made that happen. That was just how the baby developed physically. So there's a, it's subtle, the difference between genetic and congenital, but there is a difference. Down syndrome is absolutely genetic. Yeah, Linda, you had a question? Alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome. I don't, have they discovered a gene that's...
Because I don't think it's from the mother drinking.
Well, it is. A lot of it is from the mother drinking.
Yeah.
So then it would be congenital, not genetic. But if a gene was found that was passed to the baby, then it would be genetic. Yeah, but fetal alcohol syndrome that they're born with is definitely what's impacted the baby's body from the mother drinking, and that would be congenital. So see, it's a very slim definition. That's a little difficult. So that's congenital. Degenerative, a disease that gets worse, right? That results from deterioration in permanent organs, tissues, it goes down. Functional, disease that affects function or performance, okay, but does not have manifestations of organic illness. For instance, if you break your ankle, you have a functional defect. Correct. But you're still doing fine. But functionally, you have a heck of a time getting up these stairs. You have to take the elevator. Malignant, we're going to talk about cancers. That's normally when this term's used. It tends to get worse and can cause death. Yes. Psychosomatic. Okay. Physiological disease that is manifested by... No, a psychological disease manifested by physiological symptoms. Psychosomatic. And you actually may run into some of this. I had a patient that had psychosomatic seizures. Very interesting. Idiopathic, a disease of unknown cause. You'll hear this phrase a lot. It's idiopathic. Okay. You will know how it came about. You'll often hear this. And they're iatrogenic. That's a disease caused by medical therapy. What could be caused by medical therapy? Any ideas? What?
It's not sterilized, it's supposed to be sterilized for procedure.
Sure, yeah. Like in surgery, and you infected bacteria into her. Yeah. That's a good example. How about chemotherapy? Side effects from chemo? Yeah, definitely are iatrogenic. What about pneumonia that's spreading in hospitals? I kind of like the fact that there's not a word for caused by nurses. Yeah.
Clarification between
iatrogenic
and nosocomial.
Nosocomial, yeah. We more think of a treatment based problem as being iatrogenic, like consequences from chemo, like if someone had to spend in a patient. It's normally looked more as an individual problem, where nosocomial may be several patients were infected with C. diff or whatever because of the conditions of the hospital. Nosocomial is a more general term. Your iatrogenic is much more specific. The iatrogenic thrush, for instance, from chemotherapy radiation is common. Okay. Good question. So just some real basic terms that you will hear in the hospital when you go in. Illness, obviously, our response to disease is when we get ill. How we respond is very different, isn't it? Absolutely. How old we are is going to make a difference. Our gender, our family values, our social economic status, and our culture is going to make a huge difference. Educational level and mental status. How does a baby respond when they have an earache? Does cry and why? Okay, that's their only form of communication. I worked in OB for a while. The cultural influences and how the women responded to birth was fascinating. Just absolutely fascinating. And what was accepted in different cultures as far as yelling and screaming and carrying on. And, yeah. Yeah, some cultures are very stoic. Others are
Yeah. Well, it makes a difference. Culture is a huge difference, I've learned, on how people express disease. So if a sick person feels symptoms, they're starting to feel sick. Now, this assuming the sick role is huge. You're going, people will walk in the hospital, they're looking good, they come onto the floor, they're dressed, you know, they're looking okay, but they've been diagnosed with pneumonia, so they're coming in for some treatment. You put them in the bed, you put them in the gown, and they have assumed the sick role out of bed. Right? That's a huge transition. And when you watch them do it, it's very interesting. They're like some coming to the illness and they're there for treatment. And we probably all have our individual sick roles, right? We stay in our jammies and we watch the Lifetime movies, right? And I like lemon meringue pie and scrambled eggs and tea. And you know, we all have our little traditions that we do that when we're sick, we make us feel that. It's our sick role. And you watch patients in the hospital, they assume the sick role, and that's a sequence in illness behavior. So you assume the sick role, you realize you're sick, and you seek medical care sometimes. You know, many people do. As they put on that patient gown and get into bed, they become dependent, don't they? All of a sudden, they walked in independently. Now you're telling them they have to tell you when they want to go to the bathroom because they're a fall risk. How's that making them feel? So know that there's a lot of independence that's lost in a hospital patient in assuming that sick role. You probably don't do that when you cuddle up with your hot water bottle, you know, and your footed jammies, but your patients in the hospital will. They have a dependent role. Our goal is for them to achieve recovery and rehabilitation, right? We want them to recover. So eventually we're going to start getting them dressed every morning. You see a lot of this in Jerry. Yeah, it takes forever, but we get them up and dressed, and we don't want them to assume a sick role because they're not. They're just elderly. Or we want them to rehabilitate. Part of that is getting up and going. We do a lot of this in geriatrics, getting them moving. Acute illness is something that occurs rapidly. Lasts for a short time, self-limiting. We talked about that. Self-limiting means it eventually will get better, generally, unless you die from it. But most of the time, acute illness, it gets better. Okay, like a cold. It's a nice acute. Like chronic requires continual management. Okay? A chronic condition, chronic bronchitis, diabetes. So chronic illness needs, many people you will encounter in the hospital are chronically ill. Our goal is to move them to a place where they can live as normally as possible so they can adapt their daily lives, comply with a medical regime. You're going to get people that are newly diagnosed with whatever, right? Heart disease of some sort, a respiratory problem. They're going to have to go on oxygen. They're going to have to go on insulin. They have a colostomy that they're going to have to deal with. What do? We move them into society and dealing with that chronic disease state and still existing and leading productive, healthy, to a point, and happy lives, right? Don't ever underestimate the need that your patients will have for self-control. A lot of that is involved around their self-concept. How do they see themselves? Do they see themselves as a wizened old lady that can't do anything by herself? Or do they see her as a powerful woman that has a vast amount of experience to share. Okay? So you give them the respect and move them into that self-concept that it is very healthy. They're going to do a lot better if they think that they have a lot to share with the world and their experience is beneficial rather than thinking that they have nothing more to give and they're all wizened and old and they're going to curl up and die. Okay, so that's a lot of what we did. I know you had some lectures on this in last summer, right, on self-concept, so you know about that. And hope. We give hope with a caveat. Right? Realistic hope. Okay? We give realistic hope. Talked about control, that's important. Confront the inevitability of death. Yeah. You may be the only person, the dying person, will feel comfortable talking with about death. They may say to you, how long do I have? And then go ask the nurse, how long do I have? A couple days. You know? I mean, frank discussions are not at all uncommon. People are going to have those with their nurses, in my experience, before they have them with anybody else. Mm-hmm. So you work in the night shift, it's 2 a.m, and these are the times when this kind of thing happens.
And we're there for them, yeah. Because people often need to talk through this. I remember a man with pancreatic cancer said, how am I going to... He was fine with dying. He was given 2 months. He was fine with it. He was fine. His big concern was, how am I going to tell my son? So we stayed up most of that night. He role-played with me how he was going to tell his son. Then he eventually fell asleep and he felt much better. Because he wasn't worried about dying. That was going to happen. How am I going to tell my son? And that's what we're there for. We work those kinds of things through with people. So if you think you're just giving injections and putting down nasal gas or tubes, oh, that's the easy part. That is nothing compared to trying to help somebody figure out how they're going to tell their son they're dying. Okay? That's why I say your skills are just a very small part of your practice. Okay, what's primary prevention versus secondary versus tertiary? Primary prevention is health promotion activities. Okay? Kaiser again, they have their ads all over the place. Promoting health. Actions that prevent, delay the occurrence of disease. We all eat well, we walk, we drink enough fluid, right? All that. That's important. Secondary is when we want, we do screenings. Activities that emphasize an early diagnosis or treatment event. Okay? So we're going to do, maybe when you get to community health, you'll do some scoliosis screenings. That's secondary prevention. You're going to see if anybody has scoliosis. Or obviously self-breast exams, testicular exams are secondary illness prevention. Tertiary, the disease exists and we're going to stop it. Focuses on stopping the disease process and returning the patient to society. It has to do with rehab. Okay. Rehabilitate them so that they can move into society. You have a question? Immunizations would be secondary. All right. You're going to learn a lot in Jerry how people age and how people change. No, you don't have to wait until you're elderly before you start changing. I don't know if most of you are probably too young to see any changes in your body yet, but know that they're happening already. Okay? My 21-year-old son is an athlete, and I keep telling I want him to understand that this is, he's at his peak now at 21. It's kind of downhill from now on. Truly at 25, your organs start deteriorating. So, in honesty, he is at his peak. In just a few years, he's going to start going down. And yet, it starts happening a lot earlier. So you're going to learn about all the changes in Jerry, but do know that that by the time you're 30, you already have some wrinkles. Their muscles aren't as strong. It starts happening right away. So respect that in your patients. Know that, and know that they're dealing with that a little bit too. It's not all that easy, let me tell you. You know, to give up some of the things that you have to give up, like that great body, or you know, that I know I had when I was 18. You know, and so your patients are dealing with this aging, and likely that's a concept that you haven't confronted yet. So just know, and I know you talk a lot about it in aging, but bring it back down. It often also happens at the age of 30. Young adults, different age groups, have different problems that they are going to likely be presented with. Young adults commonly have injuries. They're still risk-taking, right? Who drives fast in cars? Young men, and they get killed. So, yes, injuries, substance abuse, STDs, physical and psychosocial stressors are what a young adult is experiencing. So know that that's common. So if you're dealing with someone that's 18 on the med-surg floor, we had a woman we cared for at Marin General most of last semester was 21. Yeah, think about what that person's dealing with. It's very interesting to care for someone your own age. That's a whole new psychological deal for you. I hope you have the opportunity. Students a couple years ago cared for this guy that was in with an injury from a drive-by shooting. He was a gang member. And this young man learned so much. He was just, because they could talk his peers. And he was a wonderful nurse for him because he listened. And he was able to relate and truly knew what this young man needed because they were peers. So there's a lot to it. So yeah. And young adults, we know all about this. But you're going to assess all the regular stuff. Things you need to think about. So basically, your book goes through all the all the adults, but you look at each stage. Middle adults start to get obese. Yes. Men have to be real careful about their weight, mainly because they're more sedentary. They don't get to run around as much. Okay, and you're going to talk a lot about older adults in Jerry, so we don't have to do that. Okay. Yeah, I know you've done some work on family. And you did that in last semester, so we're not going to cover that this time. Don't even know if I put it down for your reading. You did family, right? I know you did. Professor Bright told me you did. She did the whole thing on family. Okay. Let's quickly do a little bit on IVs. Let's see if we can get through some of this before we interrupt. So you're not giving IVs this semester, okay? You're not giving pushes. You're not. You may hang fluids but not turn them on. You may spike bags under the supervision of your nurse. So you're doing things extremely supervised, but you're never actually turning it on or giving a push. Okay? That's because we're protecting you. I want to protect you. You can kill somebody quicker with an IV than anything else. Because you can't get it back, right? Once it's in the blood, that's it. So I really don't want to laden you with that responsibility at this point in your career. It's not that I don't feel confident about you. I just don't think it's a good idea. Get more familiar with the whole environment. But I certainly want you to know what IVs are. I want you to know how to assess, pick up problems, and know what's going on, because they are a huge part of our practice today. There are some days where I'm giving the majority of my medications IV. Which is not good for you guys, because you want to pass the POs and give the injections. So it's a major part of treatment. It's the most common invasive procedure. Okay? Know that we do in the outpatient, inpatient settings. We administer fluids, medications, nutritional support, and infusion therapy, all through IVs. You learned about what kind of nutritional support goes through IV? I know we talked about it in our group. Everybody know about TPN? This week, right? Okay. Various techniques for putting solids and liquids into the veins. The responsibility for hazards is the nurse. Okay? So there's a problem with the IV, even though you're not pushing it or administering it, the problem is still, I want you to be able to pick it up. And that's why we're doing this lecture. We're the ones that have can directly see the influence of fluids on the body. And I know last semester, or this summer, we talked a little bit about fluid balance. When people are hypervolemic, hypovolemic, and the difference in what makes them hyper and hypo. All right? So if a little old lady comes in, she's dehydrated, we have IV fluids running, just fluids at 150 mLs an hour, she may be fine for the first couple of days. Then if nobody stops that, she's going to become hypervolemic, right? And you know what that's going to look like. Okay? So these are the kind of things that I expect you to be able to pick up with your patients on the floor. You see those symptoms of hypervolemic, hypovolemia, right? And these are the suggestions that we then make to the physician. I think she's had enough fluid, so I'm going to turn it off. Or can we turn this down? Right? So they're not just going in veins. Know that there are also times when IVs are through the artery. They can go into the bone marrow. You can get epidurals. Okay, you can do subdurals. And subcutaneous. So know that although we almost always see IVs in the vein, know that it can go in many different areas. So there are occasionally you may see something else. Often coming up from surgery, we see people with epidurals that are given for abdominal surgery. So there's a whole other line coming out of their spine. So be aware. When you first get your patient, I always go in and look at all the lines coming out of them. Do I know what this is? One of them may be an epidural from surgery that you'll see in the med search form. So that'll be part of what you're assessing. Is it running? Is it doing okay? So don't limit yourself. And this is just a cursory overview, so you're going to get much more familiar as you continue your practice. We use it for hydration, as we discussed. We use IVs to balance the electrolytes. We do meds, of course. It's a lifeline access. If you need something in the body really fast, like I remember again in OB, some woman, her blood pressure dropped instantly. We had to get that blood pressure up so that she could deliver. you're able to put that it's kind of a starch material that thickens and pushes against the vasculature and increases blood pressure. We were able to do that intravenously like that, and she was fine within 3 minutes. But we had to get that in her then, or else she and the baby both wouldn't have made it. So there are times when it truly is a lifeline access, just right now. Use it for blood replacement. Hopefully this semester you'll see that. Nutrition, talked a little bit about that, and hopefully you did last semester. Cleansing and filtering, like dialysis, right? You cleanse the blood through dialysis. There's some kinds of sickle cell anemia treatments that are done through filtering of the blood, too. So we can also use it as a filter. We talked about this in my group. I don't know if you learned this in some of the other lab groups this summer. But when you're going to watch your nurses when they're pushing IVs, they should do a saline flush, do a med administration, another saline flush, and some heparin. They may let you do the saline. Okay, you can do the saline. All right, but nothing else. So I have my student do the saline, I'll do the med, and they'll do the saline. And sometimes there's heparin. Heparin is an anticoagulant. We commonly do it in arterial lines so that they won't clot off. Generally not in your normal veins. Yes, Linda.
Can you quickly go over the timing
for that? Oh, how slow.
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to be pushing yourself.
Two minutes?
1 minute, at least a minute. No, is it at least a minute? No, at least two, you're right. At least 2 minutes. You don't want to just go in and push something in somebody's vein. What's that going to do? It may blow out the vein. You want it real slow, over 2 minutes. At least. Will you see the nurses do this in the hospital? Probably not. Okay. But when you're doing it, I think your second semester of med surgery, you get to put it just slow. I can't tell you how many patients have complimented me and said, thank you so much. It always burns the stings. Go slow, it won't. Even sometimes saline, people are very sensitive. The saline stings. Just go real slow. You don't want to bombard the body with anything. We're there to help. Make it more comfortable. It takes another 30 seconds. Okay? So watch the nurses in the hospital. Okay, IV rate. We talked a little bit about IV rates, when you would slow it down. Physicians choose IV rates based on the surface area of the body, meaning I have more surface area. I might have more surface area than someone that's a lot shorter than me and who weighs the same, right? But I have more surface area, so I might take a faster rate of an IV. Okay, so surface area, their condition, the age, composition of the fluid, the tolerance, it all has to do with the physician choosing the rate in which things are infused. These are all things I want you to start looking at when you get in the hospital. Normally, you'll see IVs running at 100 to 125 milliliters an hour if we're just maintaining someone who's not taking in any fluids. Why does that make sense? Someone's MPO, no fluids, why would this be about the rate that we'd be running? Right. You know this?
Is that how much you excrete an hour?
Close. Yeah, that's your intake in 24 hours. Yeah, would be equal to this rate. So you're taking in the same amount in an hour as you would normally within. You just take the 24-hour intake, break it up, and you get 100. You should take in about 2,400 mLs of fluid in various ways throughout the day. So that's approximately what you have IV running.
It's because you have a line that isn't for respiration.
Exactly. And metabolism got it. So in general, if something's running more than 100, 120, you want to question it. Are they dehydrated? What's going on? Are we flushing something out of their bodies? Why is it running faster than that? Normally people that are MPO are running at this rate. Okay, so that's a nice check. Those little, yes.
So would it be higher amount if they're medication?
Possibly there's something in for instance, when people have radioactive dyes injected in them for some kind of a radiographic procedure, often we'll come back, we'll put them on 150, 175 to flush that out of their real fast. So that would be an example. Yeah, maybe there's overdosing on something. Maybe they reacted too strongly, they have an allergic reaction, we may bump them out at that point. Right. So there may be, more commonly they're dehydrated. And that's how they are. But that's what we're questioning. Why? Why? Is there a reason? Why are we doing this? So those awful, those little machines that you learned a little bit about over the summer beep at you all the time, right? All the time. You go down the hall and they're beeping. So there are some things that you need to look at. Height of the bottle well. If they're in the machines, it's not. But there's a clot. Maybe there's a clot somewhere in the cannula. Maybe your person is going like this, right? And occluding it. There's some trauma to the vein. There's some vasoreactive factors. You know, maybe they're all of a sudden they got really scared. All their blood from their peripheral ran. We just told them that they were going to go down procedure. They got real scared. I've seen like the machine stopped because there's no blood there to carry it. Because all that they're like fight or flight. You know, all their blood's running into their core of their body. So that's a vasoreactive factor. Or a mechanical problem. There's a kink somewhere. There's done something wrong with the machine. So all things to check with those silly little machines. And hopefully you'll get kind of familiar. You've had an introduction to them. So get familiar with those machines. Look at them when you're in the hospital. Now we're going to go over some signs and symptoms, interventions, and prevention for complications. But I want to keep you here. This is a good stopping point. Not here, only the world. This is the last complication. And these are things I want you to be aware of. I want you to be assessing IV sites. Hematoma, you're going to see that, right? Hematoma, big bruise, okay? A local mass of evacuated blood. Generally, it's confined to a space, okay? If you see a big hematoma forming around the IV site, that is a problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what are you going to do? You're going to see a discoloration. You're going to see swelling. So you're going to elevate the extremities, some warm compresses. It's going to promote vasodilation. So the blood's going to then flow out of that area. You're going to stop the IV, notify the physician. Okay? You may put on warm compresses depending if it's allowed in your hospital. So watch out for hematomas. Okay? Let's see. Infiltration. This is extremely common. This is when the solution that's running into the vein is no longer running into the vein. It's running into the tissue outside. There's been a puncture. For some reason, the cannula is heading outside into the tissue. Fluid is leaking into the tissue. Again, you're going to see swelling. People are very sensitive then. And there's no blood return. There's no blood because it's not. It's in the tissue. It's not in the blood. The patient is uncomfortable. Again, discontinue it immediately. Elevate. Maybe warm compresses. You might need to call the physician. If a vesicant agent. Vesicant is any material that can be harmful to the skin, such as iron. Right? Most of the time, it's not. You're fine, you start a new IV, you move on. But if it's a vesicant agent, the skin may need some treatment. So, infiltration. A tension loop is good. We talked about tension loops. Remember, you had a tension loop for your nasal gastric tubes? Tension loops for IVs always. Okay, same idea. That's not going to work, is it? Phlebitis, inflammation of the vein. Again, you're going to see redness around the area, tender. It can be sterile, chemical, or septic. I'm going to close it up.
Tenderness from the same time, right? It's a different causation. It's not because infiltration,
then it feels really hard. Because there's an infection. In the vein. Be sure you anchor that cannula so it doesn't move, so it doesn't irritate the vein and cause some inflammation, which may eventually cause an infection. Okay, thrombophlebitis, inflammation of a vein associated with the formation of a blood clot. Sometimes blood clots form from putting in the cannula. Right, so know that that can happen too. The veins become hard, tortuous. Okay, extremely painful. This is very important to talk to the physician about. Because a blood clot can break away and do what? Travel, yeah, like to the heart of the lungs. So that's important. All from an IV. See how important these things are? Okay. So that's one of the reasons why we don't use legs for venipuncture. Except in rare situations. upper body, less likely to form a thromba. Infection, bacteria at site, yeah, that could be caused by not using sterile technique. That's important. If the patient is immunocompromised, you'd be even more careful. If they're an AIDS patient, they're very old, that kind of thing. Remember that every single time that you undo any of those lines, you're opening them up to infection. Remember, hospitals are full of bugs, everything that floats around. Okay? So unsnap the gown. Don't just unhook the IV and put it back. No, do the snaps. Try not to ever break that seal. That sterility that exists. Every time you open it up, you have. Just simply to end. I know you're falling asleep. It's a line. We're almost done. Infection, you have pain, swelling, all the infection stuff. You're going to notify the physician. Okay? Cellulitis, we get cellulitis too from IVs. You're going to learn what cellulitis is very quickly. Inflammation of cellular connective tissue. Redness. Cellulitis is very common. You'll see it in the hospital soon. Know that it can come from IVs. Redness, swelling, warmth, pain. Okay. What else? Nerve damage can occur too from IVs. Just some things I want you guys to be aware of. That's it. Actually, you can even get a pulmonary embolism from a blood clot from an IV. That would probably be the worst thing that can happen. So I'm just scaring you a little bit so that you're really conscious of the IVs you're working with. And you look at them, you make a part of your assessment, because I know this wasn't part of the skills you learned in assessment. So when you move into the hospital, almost everybody will have an IV when you start looking at them. We can have air embolisms too, you know that? And I think that's about it. Oh, how much air is it going to take to hurt someone?
60 cc's.
Yeah, 60 cc's. You know how much 60 cc's would be in that little microtubing?
A lot.
Heck of a lot. So nurses are really worried about all those little... Yeah, when you open up your system to get rid of the bubbles, in my opinion, that's more dangerous than if you let the bubbles go.
Wait, what's more dangerous?
To open up the system.
Right.
To let the air out is really more dangerous because you're exposing it to all those hospital bacteria than if you let the little bit of bubbles go through. But often the machine won't let the bubbles go through in your stuff. Because those machines trap all the bubbles and go, ah. But let's start looking at all these, okay, please. Oh, sometimes the catheters break off. It can cause an embolism. Yeah. Okay. Yes, you have a question?
It seems like a lot of these have very similar infections.
They absolutely do.
How would you know in that situation what you use
your respiratory? Yeah, and what did you see? I mean, what led up to it?
Okay, is it someone very, very fragile skin? Mm-hmm. And a very, very old age, that fragile vein, and then it's all, well, it's probably the same infection. It's the vein from the do you use an old camera? No, I never did it. So kind of bring it all together. And the treatment's almost all the same.
So a lot of times it really doesn't matter. And that's about it. I think I had a really cool picture at the end, though. I'm not showing that cool picture. I guess I took it out with everybody. Oh, well. Well, they should be here. We rushed to do that for them. Any general questions? Remember, like for this, I'm going to ask them
major concepts. I'm not going to spend all the time in the details. Okay? Yes. Yeah.
So, you know.
No, I truly feel that it's probably not suicide. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Good.
I was just wondering, dehydrated patients, when you pick up an IV, it's more likely to have blood clots because the blood is more viscous and thick.
Well, the question was, are dehydrated patients more likely to have clots because the blood is more thick and viscous? In theory, I would agree with you. In practice, I have not seen it happen, but I think that theoretically you're right on. It makes sense. I don't remember ever seeing that. I have had a patient or two with blood clots, but they've both been from injury. No.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else? Linda.
So for the answer to one of the questions, why patients on NPO has high needs from 120?
Yeah. No, because the normal intake of a person would be somewhere between 2,000 and 2,400 mLs within a 24-hour period. So if you took that amount, divided it by 24, you get about 100. So someone that did not have any intake, that's what you would be putting the IV at, because that's their only way to get fluid. Got it? So if it's much different than that, you should be questioning it. And sure.